Is he my prince? Is he the toad? Waiting, wondering, is getting too old. I'm gonna let down my hair, slide up my skirt. Welcome to the Shame-Free Zone with Veronica Monet, your friendly former sex worker and certified sexologist. The Shame-Free Zone is a safe place for your questions and your secrets about all things sexual.
And welcome to the Shame-Free Zone. This is your host, Veronica Monet. I don't know what the weather's like where you are, but I got a little bit of a storm brewing outside. Thunder and lightning. Anyway, it's kind of got me missing a favorite dog of mine. He passed away about a year and a half ago, and he was terrified of the thunder and lightning, absolutely terrified. He used to hide under my desk, and just before he passed away, he got brave, and one night there was this horrible storm. It was just shaking the cabin. It was so close. And he just kept facing the thunder and lightning. Everywhere it struck, he was like a guard dog. It was just amazing. So what's the point of that story? I don't know. I'm missing my dog, and I do actually think that animals have a development curve, if you will. They're not the same people all through their life. Anyway, speaking of our connection to nature, we're going to be talking about good, clean love tonight. And our guest is, or I should say my guest, is Wendy Stragar. She's up in Oregon. Oregon's my home state. And Wendy's developed these essential oils and organic intimacy products. I can't wait to hear about that. But she's also got a book. It's an amazing book. I'm looking at it right now. It's got a gorgeous cover. There's a pomegranate split open. And its title is Love That Works, A Guide to Enduring Intimacy. Wendy Stragar is the founder and chairman of Good Clean Love. And I want to welcome you to the Shame-Free Zone right now, Wendy. Thanks for joining me.
Hi, Veronica. Thanks for having me.
Hi. So you live in Eugene, Oregon, right?
I do, actually, yes.
Yeah.
Beautiful Oregon. We're having really beautiful weather right now, beautiful Indian summer weather.
Of course you are. I moved down here to get better weather.
Where are you, in L.A.?
No, I'm in Northern California, close to Lake Tahoe.
Uh-huh, that's nice there.
I
like
some people are calling you a
loveologist.
I think that's interesting. A loveologist. I'm a sexologist. Can you tell us a little bit about what makes for a loveologist?
Well, a loveologist, actually, it's funny because there are sexologists and you can go to school to become a sexologist, but sadly, there's really no place you can go to become a certified or, you know, get a degree in loveology. And it's my premise, and that's actually what you find in my book, that love is actually a set of skills that you can actually learn and get better at. And so it's a developmental process, kind of like how you were talking about your dog. And that we can, you know, that we can grow up and grow our skills in loving. And so, you know, I'm hoping someday to be successful enough to start chair of loveology at a university and set up the first kind of core curriculum classes. But I actually really believe if we sort of thought about love not just as this innate thing that we're good at because we're human, but realize that it's something that we develop skills at, we would all really get better at it if people were trained in how to love each other.
Yeah.
So, you know, sometimes you get lucky and you grow up in a family where you're really loved and those skills are transmitted, but by and large, they're not transmitted that way. And so rather than struggling for most of our lives, if we actually set up some skills about communicating and how we show up for each other and how we deal with conflict and what it really means to be physically intimate with other people, then we would have a skill set to work from.
Well, yes, and I'm looking at an article. I don't think this is actually a chapter from your book, but you'll tell me if it is. It's called Philematology or Philematology?
Oh, philematology. Yeah, that's so
sorry.
Interestingly,
Wendy,
the science of
Wendy,
kissing.
Can you say that word one more time?
Yeah, philematology.
Philematology. Thank you. Mm-hmm. Philematology, yeah. The science of a kiss.
Uh-huh. And so, you know, so even there's a science of kissing, you know, but we don't have a study of love. It's a weird thing. But yeah, philematology is an interesting study of and science about kissing, and there's a lot of great, really important historical references about how kissing started as actually a way of people smelling each other. So the idea of the Eskimo kiss, you know, like that, you know, that actually was the origins of a kiss, and you know, and it's because how we smell to each other is such a fundamental part of our. Of our mating, just the way animals smell each other. You know, humans actually are animals, right? We're in the same mammal group. And so, if you've ever tried to kiss somebody that doesn't smell good to you, it's impossible. You can't do it. And actually, that's a biological preventative of not ending up mating with the wrong person, because people who are incompatible with scent actually would not produce healthy offspring. And because there's a whole coding, we have this MHC code, which is kind of like a fingerprint for our sense of smell, and it's unique to us. And so, you know, I don't know if you've got anybody that you love seriously in your life, but probably you love smelling them. And so, you know, the scent is such a basic primary part of how we mate and how we connect, and that's one of the origins of the kiss, actually, probably the most primary origin of the kiss.
That's one of the reasons that I have a problem with online dating. It doesn't give you an opportunity to smell the person that you're romancing. And
I totally agree with you, and I've actually been trying to invent some way to build that into, like, a profile, but I still haven't figured out how to do it. There's a couple sites that do it for, like $2,500, but you have to go to a lab. It's very elaborate.
Uh-huh.
And so it's not accessible to most people, but I totally agree with you. You know, being mismatched scent-wise, even if everything else is perfect about that partner,
yeah.
It just is sort of a doom. There's no way around it.
Absolutely, and it's really about the pheromones, not so much how it smells, but what effect it has on your chemistry. I think they've done research on women, actually, have a very strong response to the odors that come off of men's underarms. It creates feelings of safety and security.
Well, you know, the interesting thing about pheromones, especially if you know anything about the industry of people producing pheromones for other people to buy,
mm-hmm.
I always think to myself, why would you want somebody else's pheromones, and just who is that anyway?
Right.
And, you know, when they try to reproduce pheromones, what happens is that there's a lot of chemical attachments that can't be broken off, and so that's why they have to cover those scents with really heavy perfumed scents. And I, you know, my love oils, you were talking about, are essential oils that could clean love, but all they do is really heighten our own pheromones, right? They just heighten, you know, each unique sort of person's sense of smell. And so they create a scent bridge between you and your partner that's unique to just you and your partner. It's kind of magical almost how it works. And it smells different all over your body because, you know, you smell different all over your body. But it's continuously giving this information to your brain, your limbic brain, which is where your olfactory bulb is, which is where you smell. And that's also where you process memory, sexuality, and emotions. So, you know, so, yeah, pheromones, you know, actually love oils is how I kind of prove to people that pheromones are real. But you don't need to go out and buy somebody else's. You know, you can just, like, heighten your own experience.
Well, and tell me a little bit about, or tell us a little bit about your good, clean, organic erotic supplies. What sort of things
yeah.
do you have?
So, you know, I started Good Clean Love like 8 years ago because I was trying to find products that didn't make me sick when I made love with my husband. I've been married to my husband for 30 years now. It's kind of
congratulations.
I can't even believe it. And, yeah, we have the best sex ever. It just gets better and better. And that I really attribute to our love products. So that was my inspiration. I was really trying to create products that would enhance my intimate life. And, you know, I have four kids, and I nursed all those kids for way too long, so I was pretty much dry all the time. And I went and I tried to use products, you know, over-the-counter products at drugstores. And even pretty much, I mean, I tried almost everything I could find, even in the adult arena. And all those products, 95 to 98% of them, depending on where you're shopping, are made with petrochemicals and preserved with parabens, methyl and propyl paraben. And so, you know, in addition to being somewhat carcinogenic, depending on the ingredient, they're also really irritants to the most sensitive tissue in your body. So, you know, the more I used it, the more I reacted. And at the end, I had to, like, soak myself in the tub for 2 hours after using those products and having sex. And I thought, there's got to be a better way.
Okay.
So that's how I started the company, actually, was that I came across a bottle of love oil, like I was just explaining to you about how those change your pheromones and kind of just really wake you up to your scent and your partner's scent. And I had this great sex for 6 months, and I thought, oh, my God, we're in such a good place. And then the bottle was gone, and I thought, oh, my God, it was the product. And so I didn't know, you know.
Right.
And so then I, of course, set out to learn more about it and try to reproduce it because I couldn't get another bottle of that stuff. And that was kind of the beginning of Good Clean Love. And so now we have a line of love oils. And, you know, once I started selling those products, and, you know, again, I was making these in my home and bottling them myself and selling them, you know, at first we had $8,000 of sales and then $25,000. And no, it's really a cottage industry, just the way you sort of could imagine this, right? And all my little kids running around. And then as it grew, some of our early customers said, you need a water-based product that's safe with latex. And so it took us about 2 years to come up with something that is now our personal lubricant that's 95% organic. And that's actually evolved a ton over all these years, too. But that's the primary product we sell now because people really understand lubricant way better than they understand love oils.
Okay. And what is the difference between a lubricant and a love oil?
Well, so, you know, this is how I explain lubricants. You know, so lubricant is a really important product, and we actually see it advertised on daytime television all the time thanks to Johnson & Johnson.
Right.
You know, they spend $32 million a year telling everybody it's okay to use a lubricant now. And that's a great service they offer all lubricant companies because now people aren't so embarrassed to buy that. But there was a time where people really were embarrassed, and still actually in some stores they are. But a lubricant is really the product you use when you can't stand it anymore, right? Because it gives you glide and extra time and, you know, a chance to experiment with new positions. But if you're not aroused, I mean, any good lubricant, even my lubricant, is only as good as your desire to be penetrated. So it's not like you just squirt on some lubricant and then, bingo, you're off to the races. You know, love oil actually wakes up that libido mechanism naturally in your brain so that by the time you reach for a bottle of lubricant, you really mean it. And then the lubricant can do its job. You know, we have people call our office and say, you know, I tried your product and it didn't work. And so then I have to have the conversation with them and say, well, let's talk about that. You know, how did you use it? You know, were you really ready for, you know, that kind of penetration activity? And
so how does the oil get you in the mood as opposed to the lube?
Well, so those oils, like I was telling you before, are made with therapeutic-grade essential oils. And so what they do is they go from your nose into the limbic part of your brain through your olfactory bulb, which, you know, your olfactory bulb, that's where you process smell, right?
Right.
And so that is actually your limbic brain. It's the same place in your brain. So where we smell is also where we process our emotions, our memory, and our sexuality. So when you use stuff to wake up that sense of smell, what you're also doing is stirring your memories and you know, creating a scent memory with somebody sexually. You know, that's why I think about, like, the first time you go outside and it smells like summer. You, like, automatically flash back to when you were 4 years old and you walked outside. you know, and sex has a certain odor too. And so when you associate that with love oils, you know, all I have to do is crack open a bottle of Origins and I'm like ready to go to bed, you know. Because that scent is really associated heavily with making love.
So is it mostly the scent then that is the cue?
Yeah, it's scent.
Yeah.
And it's interesting because scent changes all over our body. Think how different your genitals smell from your breasts, from your lips. Mm-hmm. And so when you use love oil all over your body, what you're doing is you're sending this intense amount of information to this part of your brain through scent, right, to wake up to its arousal mechanism, you know. And so, you know, and think about history. I mean, pretty much all of the greatest lovers in history have used scent as, I mean, it was always married to sexuality. I mean, Cleopatra sort of soaked her, because she was a queen, right? She was able to soak her sails in her, you know, of her ship in rose oil before going after Mark Antony. Let me just tell you, he stopped what he was doing, you know. So, you know, she used to make love on a bed of 10 inches of rose petals. You know, now you can just use a little bit of rose oil and get that same effect. But, you know, all of the great lovers in history have used scent. You know, Napoleon used to write to his wife to not shower for 5 days when he was coming home because he was so eroticized by her natural scent.
Well, this is, you know, speaking of scent, it's very interesting because I'm looking at this blurb from Gina Ogden, the author of mm-hmm. Women Who Love Sex, The Heart and Soul of Sex, and The Return of Desire. You've got a nice blurb from Gina Ogden here. It says, love that works is a breath of fresh air. Mm-hmm. So, Wendy Strigar writes, with the sensitivity of an old soul who draws wisdom from others and adds plenty of her own, there's information and nourishment on every page, whether you're seeking the last word on vibrators and lubrication or searching for sage advice or guidance on how to create a more delicious and sustainable relationship. And, it does seem that you have put quite a bit of research into your book, which I get books about sex and relationships all the time.
Yeah.
Research seems to be on the decline. So, mm-hmm. so I'm finding it very interesting, the details and just to find out how things work. It's amazing to me because I'm a certified sexologist. There's a lot of this stuff I didn't know.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's good to know. I'm happy to hear that.
Yeah.
So
I mean,
for instance,
I didn't know one of the theories behind kissing was that could have been the mastication of food for young.
Actually, that makes a lot of sense when you think about, like, really deep French kissing and how, you know, I mean, you can see how that would easily have developed, you know, about mothers pre-chewing their food for their
uh-huh.
children.
It actually, with your lover, it can be quite erotic if you know, it's a piece of chocolate or a piece
totally.
Of fruit.
Yeah, and or some really nice brandy.
Passing that back and forth with your tongues.
Yeah, it's very sexy.
Now you have a chapter here on online porn. It's interesting. You call it three-dimensional relationships, and one of the headlines here is demand the real thing in your intimate life. Don't give your life energy away to a computer screen.
So in my defense of that, because I'm sure you have a lot of listeners who spend a lot of time and really enjoy all kinds of adult activities online, and, you know, here's the thing. Everything has its place, and I would never be one to say never do that, but, you know, if you get to a place where you're choosing that over being with the person that you live with, then I think that would be a time for reflection. You know, I've always allowed my children to watch some TV and eat some crappy cereal a few times a year, because otherwise, you know, if you never have access to those things, then it's like, you know, that's the unknown, that's the forbidden, you want it all the more.
Right.
So, yeah, go experiment, look at it, but don't allow that relationship, which is easy. It's easy to have a relationship like that online where you're not really engaged and doing the work with loving somebody. I mean, I just want to say right up front, my book is called Love That Works, because loving people is hard work. That's why people fail at it so often, because as soon as they start to feel like their heart is a little bit compromised, you know, they run for the hills. You know, but the truth is that the heart is the strongest muscle in the body, and the more you use it, the stronger it gets. So that's what that third dimensional story is about, is just, you know, because I get questions from a lot of readers and people who follow the website and all this, and, you know, I've gotten many questions, you know, my husband's really, or my partner's really devoted to, you know, online porn, but, you know, he's more interested in that than me.
Oh, yeah.
That's a problem.
Yeah, I refer to it as the pornification of our culture, and it seems just rampant at this point. As a sexologist, I have clients who, especially female clients, who are kind of the victims of this pornified culture because they are trying to engage in certain sex acts that really don't work anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Or never did work, but they certainly look like they're working in the pornographic film.
Well, you know, but the whole thing is let's just say, and you know this from your own history, right, that, you know, pornography is fiction. And what's really tragic is that because it dominates so much space, you know, on the Internet and all these other places, that, you know, kids who have no education, if you grow up in a society where it's just say no, and we don't even offer them naming body parts anymore in many places in the country, you know, then it's like what they're left with is, you know, learning what sex is through pornography, and that they think that's how you do it. But, you know, the truth is that's fiction. That's not how you do it. And, you know, and to walk away feeling like, oh, I'm not good enough, or I'm not big enough, or I'm not whatever enough because I can't do it like that, you know, that's a real disservice that pornography does for everybody.
Well, it does, and there's a lot of women who are trying to figure out why they can't get off during anal sex, or why it doesn't turn them on when somebody ejaculates in their face. And it's just so sad because mainstream pornography, there are different types of pornography, but mainstream pornography really has catered to male sexual desire as it's expressed in this culture for the mainstream. And that doesn't really take into consideration female arousal cycles at all.
Yeah, no, that is so true. And in addition to that, I don't even know if most men really, like, you know, if that's what they want most, to ejaculate on a woman's face, or if they really want to be loved in whatever way a woman can love them. But, you know, again, we sell that as what it looks like to, you know, be a man, or, you know, be a sexual man. And, you know, a 17-year-old boy who has no other conversation or no other access to any information at all will see that, and then that's what they believe.
Yeah.
And yeah, part of my work, you know, because I'm raising two sons, I didn't want them to learn that as what it means to be a sexual human being. You know, I want them to feel good about their sexuality and to know that it's that the real reward of sexuality is that it's relational. That's the biggest gift we're given in our relationships. And so, you know,
well, that is actually one of your talking points, creating a sex life that nourishes both partners.
Totally. That's where sex transforms us, right? I mean, that's where, you know, our sexuality is more than just physical acts or sort of this sort of chasing after an orgasm, because, you know, orgasm is not something you can make happen. You know, it's something that you can open yourself to. It's something that you can prepare yourself for and can, you know, but it's like, I compare orgasm to forgiveness a lot. It's not something you can force, but it's something you can be prepared and open for, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And but because we all have this performance culture and we believe that real good sex looks this way and has this particular climax, it's like we forget about the process of making love, and that there, you know, there is nowhere that we're getting to, but that the doing is the reward, you know. And
So, and you talk about forging a working compromise that inspires both partners. What might that look like?
Well, in the context of what we're talking about, I think I've mentioned, that I have these four kids. So my oldest daughter is 22, and she's just moved in with her boyfriend. And, a lot of her friends will come and talk to me as well. But, when you're young, I get these questions all the time. It's like, what does an orgasm feel like? Or how do I know if this is really an orgasm, we see these images of what it should look like, and I don't know, was that it, where we don't even trust our own experience. And so, I think early in a relationship, when a couple is young and new together, forging that working compromise means that you take the time that it takes, that both people are really actually invested in the other person's pleasure. And so, for a woman, a young woman, that might, that might take some time for her to feel like she can be vulnerable and open up and experience sort of the mysterious feelings of arousal that happen. And I remember actually in my early years with my husband how, every now and again we would kind of get it right and I would have this great orgasm. I never knew how I did it, and I didn't know how to do it again, So there were way more times where I couldn't get there, and it was really frustrating. And so, of course I didn't have this level of skill or capacity to talk about it at the time, but, it's the kind of thing that I try to teach now where it's like, okay, well, so slow it down, back it up and think about, what positions were you trying? Who was doing what? How long did you take? I don't know if you ever give this advice as a sexologist, but, a woman should have an external clitoral orgasm before there's any penetration. I just kind of count that as a rule, because any time that I've had penetration without, enough stimulation to have a clitoral orgasm or at least something approximating that, then, I've had a lot of pain associated with that.
Well, everybody's bodies are different, and so I very rarely make rules for people when it comes to sex, but I certainly think that setting the bar and saying that, part of foreplay could be an orgasm before penetration sounds like a winning proposition for a lot of people.
Well, and actually what's nice about that as a proposition, and again, of course, it's different for everybody, and, sexuality is such a mysterious thing that I don't mean to set any barriers or offend anybody by saying that, but what you're doing by setting up the space for that is actually extending the time you love somebody. So, we know that men and women have very different arousal cycles, in terms of how much time. And so, if the couple can really take the time for a woman to find her space, usually then she can catch up to the man, because I know for a lot of people, I get this question all the time where, how do you figure out that timing, And, when men are younger, I think the younger they are, it takes them a while to learn that kind of control and kind of being able to last. Premature ejaculation is definitely one of the top questions that, I'm sure, between that and am I normal? I want this. Is that normal? That's what people usually come in asking. But that's a nice way to deal with it. So I don't know. Did I answer your question just now? I'm not sure.
I think then working compromise, you're looking for timing when it comes to lovemaking so that men and women can try to match each other's timing
and just lighten up, just to like not allow sort of the gravity of it to control the story, but to actually find some humor and kindness in the process so that even if you don't achieve the orgasm you want or that you miss each other with your timing, that there's something sort of gentle and generous about the encounter.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. I think we're in a culture now that is incredibly oriented towards what things look like and how well they perform, quote unquote.
Right.
So we're very busy being human doings. We're not really human beings. We're not enjoying our head space or our heart space very much. We're task oriented, and it's, you know, I'd heard something really atrocious, which, you know, at the advent of DVRs or TiVo, which gives people an opportunity to record their favorite programs through their televisions, this has become another onerous thing to put on their to-do list. So, yeah. So people feel kind of bombarded by their technology. I think some people also feel that way about their Facebook page, that they can't get off of there because there's so much to managing it.
Well, it's such an addictive cycle, too. I mean, you can spend 2 hours on there and have done nothing.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's a way that we get to look into other people's lives. And
that energy then comes into the sex life and relationships, where it becomes kind of like, you know, did we have sex today or did we have sex this week? And you know, let me hit, okay, I'll kiss you, then I'll go down to your earlobes and your neck, and then I'll go down to your breasts, and then I'll go down to, you know. It's like paint-by-numbers kind of thing, instead of it being an intuitive and fully bodied experience.
Well, you know, I feel like that's a really important kind of conversation to have about everything. But, you know, just bringing your full presence into whatever you're doing, you know, and especially lovemaking, you know. But, you know, the thing is that I think it's a really intense thing to actually know your erotic self and feel safe with your erotic self and be able to share that. I don't know that there's really anything that's more vulnerable that we share in our lives with somebody. Mm. And so, you know, this is why in Love That Works, you know, my conversations about sexuality and orgasm are towards the back of the book. And at the beginning of the book, I talk about how you think about your partner and how you think about your life, because that really is your life.
Mm-hmm.
And it certainly is your relationship. So I'm sure you've seen people who have all kinds of negative thoughts about what they're doing or the person they're with. And, you know, even when you don't say that stuff out loud, people know what you're thinking. You know, mm-hmm. You always know if somebody's having really bad thoughts, even if they're not saying it. And so a lot of people try to build a vibrant, intimate life on, you know, a marsh, which is full of all these muddy, disgusting thoughts. And it doesn't work. So there's a lot of chapters in there about how you think and really giving people the benefit of the doubt and sort of creating a ground where you can build a fire.
And then you also talk about it is heroic work to make and keep a promise. Going back to your premise again that relationships are work, that's what makes them work. Working the relationship makes it work. It is heroic work to make and keep a promise.
Yeah, so, you know, promises, which is like what? When we marry somebody, we actually make these really serious promises. You know, I will love you even if you get sick. You know, through better or worse, even if we're both out of a job, we're going to make it work. You know, I mean, we make these promises to people, and then it's like we're almost out of body when we do it. And then, like, you know, the honeymoon's over, and we are faced with this person who's not this idyllic version of who we thought they were. And then we're like, this isn't working. This is uncomfortable. This is, like, you know, not making me happy every 5 seconds. You know, and so those are the two big thinking errors that I see all the time, is that we believe that relationships should be easy or easier or getting easy, and we believe that and that they should make us happy. We believe we should be happy because we're with somebody. And I actually really have vivid memories of the first 10 years of my marriage, and I was so mad at my husband, like, pretty much all the time. I can't even believe he stayed with me, because I wasn't happy. Here's, like, I was married. I thought this was going to do it. But it's like happiness is an inside job. No relationship can make you happy. You can enjoy your own happiness with somebody else. But it took me a very long time to learn that. And I feel like it's not a lesson that's readily taught, that most people don't get that we think what we do in our outside world, what you were saying, all that stuff about how we're doers and not beers, and we We somehow believe that our happiness, we can buy it at a store, we can get it in a movie, we can, you know, or our partner. Above all, our partner will make us happy. And it just simply isn't true. So that's a lot of the groundwork. And then that next chapter about communication is the air that flows between people. And I think for me in my marriage, that was one of the weakest places in our marriage. My husband's real quiet. You know, I have to wait a real long time to listen to him. And it took me a long time to be patient enough to wait. But men and women in general have very different communication styles, and how many words they communicate to say the same thing, it's just different. And so really cultivating the ability to listen and to wait, you know, is a huge thing. And that's actually what feeds the fire. That's the air that feeds the fire. To make a passionate marriage with somebody or a passionate relationship with somebody. And then the third piece is the water, and that's the ebb and flow of, like, how you show up for somebody in your relationship. And so if you never feel like there's somebody at your back, and that means different things to different people, just like we were talking about sex, then the relationship doesn't feel safe if you don't feel like that there's somebody there showing up for you ever. And then it's very, very hard to have an erotic conversation with somebody when you don't feel emotionally safe.
Absolutely. And, you know, speaking of sexual dysfunction, which you mentioned just a couple of minutes ago, you list 32 million women and 22 million men in the U.S. ages 30 to 65 suffer from some level of sexual dysfunction. This includes vaginal dryness, lack of arousal, low libido, and pain during physical intimacy. And you have some treatments for these issues. They're natural solutions. Can you tell us a little bit about the products that you use for instance, let's say, lack of arousal and low libido?
Right. Well, so, you know, we were talking about a little bit about this at the beginning, but so I feel like all these things we were just talking about, like how you have really good sex that deals with those sexual dysfunction issues, is by communicating well, or at least working towards communicating well, cultivating good positive thoughts about yourself and your relationship and the person you're with, and showing up for them, like keeping a promise, what you were asking me about keeping a promise. So sometimes it's not convenient, sometimes it breaks up what we really think we want, and sometimes it's the most important thing we can do, and it's a lot of work. So all of those things, I think, feed into dealing with sexual dysfunction issues. And so it's like I wish I could say, listen, I have this magic bottle, and if you just use this magic bottle, then your sexual dysfunction will go away, because then I'd have a really incredible business. I'd sell so many products. But the truth is that a great lubricant, which is really good for dryness issues and, you know, can help with libido a little bit, because there's nothing like sort of the experience of wetness to sort of remind you what your body does naturally.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the love oils, like I was talking about earlier, kind of stimulate the arousal mechanism through your olfactory and your sense of smell. But those products are only as good as your willingness and curiosity and wanting to know and share your erotic self with somebody. And so if you're not, if you don't feel like somebody's showing up for you, then you're not going to want to show up in that way. And if you feel like you can't communicate because somebody cuts you down or is constantly sarcastic when you speak, then how can you open up in an erotic way? And if you are feeling like somebody is sort of looking at you with daggers in their eyes, even if they're saying nothing, how could you possibly want to have an erotic relationship with them? So the book is set up around these early chapters, and it was really my customers, actually, who asked me all those questions. You know, a lot of the stories in the book come from stories, you know, that we sort of fictionalized to, you know, so it was safe for people to tell me stories. But, you know, it's like kind of combinations of stories of people that I've actually met over the years. And so those questions that I dealt with were questions that people brought to me.
Yes, absolutely. I understand. You know, you also say that 95% of intimacy products are petrochemical-based and contain parabens, and that this can cause burning and itching and also exacerbate the existing dysfunctional issues. You can
share. So the interesting thing is that there was this study done last year, and I'm going to try and look up and see if I can find out where that was done. But it was a study done by who was it? I'm so sorry that I'm not remembering, but I'm going to see if I can find it for you here. It was a study done by this group that's that have you ever heard of hypos? Here, let's see if I can find this for you, so I don't sound like an idiot. We donate product to the HIV Alliance in town.
Okay.
And so the HIV Alliance took our products and they sent it to a lab to test its molarity. And molarity is actually a measure of how similar the product is to human the moisture level. And so it's the way, it's like this thing called isomolarity, and I really didn't understand it very well. But so there was this study done on the molarity of the top six lubricants, so Astroglide, Grease, you know, all these ones that you see, generally speaking, in adult stores, a lot of adult stores. And a lot of them actually create fissures and tears in this most sensitive tissue in the body because they're hypoisomolar. And our product is almost the same molarity as the human body. And so so anyway, I was really proud when I got that letter from the HIV Alliance. But, you know, I until this last year when they did this study in 2010, I had no idea that, you know, I mean, I had a feeling from my own experience that, you know, that our product was different, but I didn't have any scientific backing. But now there's actually all this scientific evidence that supports what I've been kind of saying.
Sure.
All along.
And there are certain ingredients that our listeners would want to avoid in their intimate products. What are those?
So anything that ends with paraben, methylparaben, propylparaben, you know, those are actually listed on many webs like natural, you know, where there's these websites that list product ingredients and tell you which ones to avoid. And those are actually found in carcinogenic studies, breast cancer tissues. So I just found this study, and this was from May 2010, it was the Microbiocides 2010 conference at the University of Pittsburgh, where they found that these lubricants, Astroglide, Elbow Grease, ID Glide, KY Jelly, were actually damaging the epithelium of the rectal and cervical tissue because they're hyperosmolar. See, I don't even know what that meant when I read it, but basically, it's like this level of moisture, molecular moisture.
Uh-huh.
And so, at any rate, I can send you the study if you want. But so, you know, ingredients like what all of those products are made with the same ingredient. If you compare label to label, you know, and so propylene glycol, polyethylene glycol, as I mentioned before, methylene propylparaben. You know, these ingredients are found in products like oven cleaner
oh my Lord!
Yeah,
really?
Brake fluid. You know, I mean, a lot of products that, you know, have nothing to do with the most sensitive tissue in our body. But, you know, lo and behold, this is what we made lubricant out of. And so, you know, when you consider the size of the market of those products, it's pretty remarkable, actually. And so it's not that surprising if you, you know, have had a baby and you're nursing, or you're getting older and you're in perimenopause and you have dryness. I mean, there's a million reasons. Just stress sometimes can create dryness, you know. And then you use these products once you have that cycle of dysfunction, and, you know, and then you've got itching and burning at the party too. You know, so if you can't really pronounce something very well, you know, on a label, then you probably don't want to use it.
So you know, the term that you were having some difficulty with there, hyper smaller, was that it?
Yeah, there you go. Thank you.
And I'm not clear on how that applies to this, because it seems like it's usually associated with diabetes, but is it like a dehydration of the tissues?
I think so, because it actually creates fissures and tears.
Amazing. Amazing. Yeah. And yet it's touted as a lubricant.
So it's really weird, isn't it? The world is weird. And, you know, and so I, like I said, I started this because those products made me really, really sick. And, you know, I don't know if it's fully 50 million people, but, you know, I do have some statistics in our materials that, you know, sexual dysfunction is almost more common than it is uncommon. I mean, a lot of people through a life cycle deal with those symptoms, you know, whether it's men or women, right? I mean, so vaginal dryness, pain with sex, and low libido. You know, I mean, you know, whether you're, you know, taking some medications creates that. You know, even antihistamines can sometimes create dryness issues. You know, and, you know, having a baby and, you know, all of the stuff that goes with that.
Menopause.
Being really stressed, exhausted can create it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, perimenopause or menopausal symptoms create it. I mean, there's a lot of reasons you might have those problems, is all I'm trying to say. And
well,
so,
it's, and I think, you know, one of the things that's so important here is to just really highlight how complicated you know, complex women's sexual response is and women's bodies are. It's,
totally.
You know, it's a beautiful, beautiful, you know, thing. And at the same time, it's not as simple as just achieving an erection or an ejaculation. There's so many things going on inside of our bodies as women that aren't really accounted for or honored, I think, in the current culture. So.
Right, and even, you know, for men, I mean, you know, an ejaculation disorder or premature ejaculation, like you said, or erectile dysfunction, I mean, you know, on some level, you know, maybe it seems like more simple biology, but, you know, it has just as devastating an effect, you know, on men when they deal with that, you know.
Absolutely.
Interesting thing is that there's almost equal numbers of men and women who suffer with something, you know?
Yes, yes.
So,
I'd say that modern sex is not working for people.
Yeah.
I want to make sure that we end on a note pertaining to relationships and love, because a large part of your book, it really does address that. And I'm looking at cultivating love. You've got a highlighted quote here, love can, in fact, reinvent our world. I think it's a beautiful quote, and I'm wondering if you'd like to expand that concept a little bit for our listeners.
So I actually really do believe that love is the cure that we're looking for. It's actually the highest part of what it is to be human, comes from our capacity to love. And like I was talking about earlier, you know, learning to practice just some of the basic skills of loving somebody is really, I mean, it's accessible to anybody, you know, and we all have that as a seed inside of us, our capacity to love. And, you know, this is the thing that I sort of encounter more and more and sort of repeat almost as a mantra every day, is that when you think of the last 10 minutes of your life, and I was just writing about this, about the 9/11 thing, you know, what all these people are remembering 9/11, and what I remember most about that time was these beautiful phone calls of people sort sort of desperately reaching out to their family and their loved ones, saying, please remember how much I love you. There was no calls for revenge or anything else. All it was, I love you, you know, and please know how much I love you. And that is all there is time for, you know, when we're about to leave this planet. And it's the only thing that matters. It doesn't matter what kind of car you drove or how nice your closet was or how great your house was. What matters is who you loved and who loved you back. And when you consider how little time we actually give our lives of that, when that is really a thing we want most, you know, that's why I do this work, because the only thing that really matters is the success we have with our hearts.
Yes, well, and seriously, getting having healthy love and relationships and a happy connection to your own sexuality, I think, goes a long way to establishing a peaceful presence on this planet. So
totally. Think how it would change the world.
Yes.
I mean, the whole world would be different if people really focused on loving each other.
Yeah. And well, Wendy, I want to thank you for putting your own sex-positive voice out into the culture and helping to make your contribution to world peace. Thank you so much. And once again, your book, Love That Works, A Guide to Enduring Intimacy, the author again, my guest, Wendy Strigar, who's up in Oregon. And our listeners can find you at what website?
You can go to www.goodcleanlove.com, and you can also go sign up for the newsletter. So I put out a newsletter every week, which is always kind of a different idea about how you love people or how you have better sex. And that's called Making Love Sustainable, so you can go to makinglovesustainable.com, or you can go to daily.goodcleanlove.com, which is where we have a really beautiful resource magazine that would answer just about any question you could think of. So,
thank you, Wendy. I really appreciate it. To my listeners tonight, I want to thank you for tuning in. I also want to let you know that next week my guest is going to be a penthouse playmate. Actually, she's interviewed me before. Now it's my turn to interview her. And she's also got a brand new book. It's called The 30-Day Sex Solution. Her name is Victoria Zrock Wilson. And it should be a very interesting visit that she and I will be having. So I hope that you'll tune in next Monday at 9. That's it from the Shame Free Zone for this week. Good night.
Thank you for tuning in tonight. If you liked what you heard and you want more solutions for your love life, please call me toll-free at 888-903-0050. Once again, that number is 888-903-0050. I am the only person who answers that line, and I am usually available Monday through Friday from 10 a.m. to 10 p.m. Pacific Time. You can also visit sexwithoutshame.com to discover more of what I can do for you. And remember, your secret is safe with you. Sering kesepian, kenapa tak mutus kabar berita?